to be astonished.
It's that time again.
Let's get started.
From the Clatsop County Historical Society, an adventure in history with Matt Burns and Alana Quila.
You should never be allowed to talk to people.
Some people without brains do an awful lot of talking.
And now, with today's adventure, it's Mac and Alana.
Good evening and happy St. Patrick's Day to everyone listening this evening. Hope you had some good corned beef and cabbage if you're listening later on.
So it's been a while since I've done this, but the first museum I worked in was a living history site in Wichita, Kansas, Old Cowtown Museum. And we had big festivals on the grounds and all staff had to get in costume and do different things. And somehow I got just dropped in the very first time. Selling bottled root beer at a little stand, like I was a little kid, like with a lemonade stand.
Yeah.
And the curator was a stuffy old guy. And it was the first time I'd been in costume. And he came up to me and he said, "Who do you think is going to win in our next election?" And it's supposed to be 1876. And I'm trying to think, oh my gosh, who was running? So the first thing that popped in my head, I just said, "Oh, I'm an Irish immigrant. My name is Willie McBride. I don't know about your elections and your politics here." And for the next 4 years, I was Willie McBride.
Oh, my goodness.
And I always had to sell the root beer. I had a whole shtick. Willie McBride's magic cure-all elixir. I stand behind me product, about a foot behind my product.
You sold it well.
And it's guaranteed to keep elephants away. You haven't seen any elephants today, have you? See, it works.
That's and good.
It was this iconic thing, and I know it's the worst Irish brogue ever.
No, I think it's good.
And then one time I had a guy from Ireland come up and said, "Where are you from, are you now? Ireland, is it?" And I said, "Well, what part are you from?" And he said something. I said, "I'm from the other part."
Nice. So, did he laugh?
A little bit.
A little bit.
I think he was more amused that I was pulling it
He's
off.
He's like, "This is what they do in America."
So when you say St. Patrick's Day, that instantly I just picture Willie McBride in a bad bowler standing behind a little wooden shelf with a big crate full of bottled root beer behind me.
So do you eat corned beef? Do you eat corned beef on St. Patrick's Day? Either of you?
I do not.
You do not?
Are you Scottish or
I'm Scottish.
Irish?
More Scottish. I'm a mutt. I'm a little bit of
Thank
everything.
Thank goodness. Boy. McAndrew Burns.
You are one of the like five people that call me by my full given name.
Oh, man. Talk about a Caledonian Claymore. You know, the Hebridean. Just like bagpipes to me. I've got Scottish blood. It gets me going right here. What Clarendonis or McAndrew Burns?
What clan are you?
McIndoe and McMillan.
Do they get along with Campbell clan?
No.
Oh, then I guess we're sworn enemies.
Oh, sworn enemies.
Yeah.
Well, if you haven't recognized the voice yet, we do have Theron Riggs here with us. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, and keeping Mac on his toes.
The first time I met Theron, he was asking what Mac was short for, and I told McAndrew, and he said, "I'm never going to call you Mac."
There you go.
And I respect that. I love that.
Yeah. So does your mother.
That's exactly my parents and at least two or three other people, and that's about it.
That's it.
And salesmen that just see the name and don't know.
Right.
That's how you know.
That's how I know. All right, because this show is going to be packed full of great stuff. Let's get right to it.
Yep, I got my word. This is the word we're bringing back. These are old words, historic words, words that are no longer used. So we're using them. And this word is a noun, axismus.
Oh, my goodness.
Say it again.
Axismus.
And it's a noun.
Yep, 16th century.
Okay, so I always guess first so that the guest can appear smarter than I when I say something really stupid.
And he did get one right.
A guest did.
You're right. It was the guest.
I came close.
It was the guest.
Okay, so say it one more time.
Axismus.
Okay, I think that that is a day after you're done with a big job and you feel really relieved and comfortable.
Nope, not even close.
Not even close.
I feel it's how you feel when you get off the toilet.
Oh. Nice. It not even close either. A fake refusal of something you really want.
Oh.
Fake, yes.
Like, please don't throw me a birthday party.
Right.
And you secretly want the birthday party.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exismus.
I don't think that one's coming back.
All right. Well, okay.
We can try again.
We're trying.
We'll try again next week. Okay, so these are the history highlights, things that happen tomorrow, March 18th. So as always, icebreakers or bar trivia, or if you're on Jeopardy, these may be the questions. 1852, Henry Wells and William Fargo start shipping and banking company.
I knew you would like that one.
Wells Fargo.
Of course.
I knew the historian for Wells Fargo.
Oh, really?
I don't know why I threw that out. I'm name dropping for no reason.
For the bank.
For the entire company.
Okay. Yeah, for the Wells Fargo. Oh, yeah. A historian. Oh, I love that. Yeah, that they hired
They have
one?
A corporate historian. At least they used to 20 years ago. I don't know if they still do. 1881, Barnum and Bailey Circus, traveling as the greatest show on earth, debuts at Madison Square Garden in New York City following a merger of two existing circus groups. Have we ever seen it?
The Greatest Showman?
Yeah, well, no.
Or the circus?
No, the circus. I don't think so. Barnum and Bailey.
I don't recall going to circuses.
I did. I saw it at Madison Square Garden. This show. It was not 1881 when I saw it.
Right.
I don't know how I feel. I always feel badly for the animals.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. 1882, Morgan Earp is assassinated by outlaws while playing billiards in Tombstone. Morgan Earp.
There we go.
Brother of Wyatt.
Wyatt Earp.
Oh, it wasn't Wyatt.
No.
It wasn't Wyatt. No, but that was his brother.
In Tucson.
Not there. It was in Tombstone.
Tombstone.
Yeah, Tombstone. Because the gunfight at the OK Corral, the other guys came and started trying to kill everybody. But of course, that begs my other thing that I was in the movie Wyatt Earp for 15 seconds.
Ooh, I love that.
All right, we'll move along though. 1889, Dr. Susan La Flèche Picotte becomes the first Native American woman to graduate from medical school.
Oh, I didn't see that one. Love that.
1889, I love kind of how early that is.
Yes.
1931, the first electric shavers go on sale in the U.S., made by Schick.
Oh, nice.
All right, 1933, American automaker Studebaker goes bankrupt. Oh, poor Studebaker. 1965, the Poppin' Fresh Pillsbury Doughboy is introduced.
1965. Okay.
I don't really like him. I don't like the giggle when you poke him in his stomach.
Okay. It's clever, though, and it's stuck around. So.
Yeah, because I love the space stuff. 1965, Soviet cosmonaut Alexei Leonov leaves a spacecraft, Vostok 2, for 12 minutes and becomes the first person to conduct a spacewalk.
Oh, cool.
I'm sad. I mean, I get Cold War, we're competing with the Russians, but I kind of hate that Americans don't really know the very first people, because except for landing on the moon, they were kind of first on everything. And that's kind of amazing to step out of a capsule and you don't know if you're getting back in safely.
Oh, my gosh.
Okay. But our history highlight of the day thing, I think, had the most impact on history. And this might be a bit of a stretch, but the concept of it is what I like. 1662, the first public bus service begins, promoted by, and I'm not going to say this right, Blaise Pascal, operates in Paris as the Carrossos et Cinq Sous until 1675.
Interesting.
A public bus system.
Right.
So,
do you have any information about who was
the first bus rider?
No. Right.
I don't know. I didn't do any deeper dive.
Okay.
Maybe.
Like, was it serving the lower class or a middle class? I mean, obviously, people that are working.
Yeah,
right?
I would assume lower class or working class of trying to get from one place to the other. I'm assuming it was not shoppers and that kind of thing. But a bus service.
Yeah. Great.
And the recognition, 1662, that we should be transporting the public.
I like public transportation.
Less personal horses.
Yes. Less poop in the streets. Remember?
That's right. We did a whole show on
that. We did that.
So that's my history highlight of the day. What did I miss?
You didn't. Those were good. I saw some of those. And I love that first Native American woman who graduated.
Yeah. I was tempted to do a deeper dive on that one, too.
Yeah.
Well, what about St. Patrick?
I didn't do anything on St. Well, because that was yesterday.
That was.
So that's why.
That was today. Right. But we're doing.
Well,
we do
this yesterday. Yes.
We do Monday so that people can outsmart their colleagues at work.
Yeah, once upon a time the show was on 12:30, so we would give the things for today.
Yep.
But when we're doing 8:30 at night here, I'm assuming nobody's chatting anymore. Maybe with your spouse before you go to bed, or maybe these could be like kids' bedtime stories.
Right.
Probably not. All right, we're eating daylight here because we got a great show.
We do.
I should plug Thursday Night Talks is this Thursday at Fort George Brewery, and it's going to be our guest, Thrawn Riggs, Captain Thrawn Riggs. So I'm really excited. But it's the usual deal. 6 o'clock, the doors open. 7 o'clock is when the program starts. So you can stop in and get some snacks beforehand. It's free and it'll last about an hour. And he's got a brand new book, and that's why we're going to talk here. So, Captain Thrawn Riggs, you have been in the maritime industry your entire adult life.
Mm-hmm.
So I have one first question, and then I want to back up to like, where did you grow up and how did you get this interest? But your very first job was as a
wiper.
A wiper. So what is a wiper?
A wiper.
A wiper.
Yeah, it's A wiper is an engine room janitor, basically. Someone who hauls trash out of the shaft alley way down there. That kind of work. Huh. In the mornings, you would clean up all the, you'd haul every bucket, 5-gallon bucket of trash up. And unfortunately, over the side, we're talking mid-60s. And that was a lot of work. Took about 2 hours to do that. Then there'd be some job going on, and you'd hold a flashlight or go get tools for someone or swab the deck after them. That's a wiper. It's entry-level job in the engine room on shifts.
How old were you?
I had to be 17.
Oh, my goodness. 17?
Yeah. Yeah, I got out. Usually, nowadays, you have to be 18 to go on shifts, but that was Vietnam era, and there was what they called waivers. You could start earlier. Same thing with licensing. If you had a second mate's license, you could sail chief mate. All kinds of restrictions that were loosened in those days.
And what was this first ship? Where was it?
This was a tanker. I joined it in a roadstead up El Segundo, and we went to Hawaii first. And it was on a triangle run. We went from Hawaii to Alaska to the West Coast, up and down the West Coast a bit, back out like that.
And how did you find this job, and how many people were on board this vessel?
My dad worked for Standard Oil. He's an executive at Standard Oil. And getting out of high school, I was a black sheep in the family, and it was his last gesture to help me get going in my life, get me a job on a ship. And boy, I loved it. I took right to it and didn't look back.
So where did you grow up? And
I grew up in Manhattan Beach, California.
Lovely.
And was there, I mean, had you been, did you like the water?
Yeah.
Were you a boater already?
I was a surfer.
Oh, nice.
From the time I was, you know, old enough to hold a surfboard. And we lived very close to the beach, and that was a great place to grow up. The family, you know, you just tell your mom you're going down to the beach. That was it for the day. They didn't worry about you. So they encouraged that, and I had an affinity for the water from the start.
So you say you were the black sheep. What did you think you were going to do? What did you ever think, or were you just going to surf for the rest of your life?
I was going to surf for the rest of my life. Yeah. That was about it. But, the light bulb came on. I loved being on the ship, the travel, the money, all the exotic personalities and places. And in fact, I was enrolled to go to school. And again, Vietnam, I kept a semblance of being enrolled at school to keep a deferment. But I never attended school. I was never a student.
Well, I'm glad if you didn't attend school, at least you didn't attend Vietnam as well.
Right.
So. Well, I went there on a ship more than once, yeah. Because that's where all the ships were going in those days on the West. Not all, that's an exaggeration, but there are a lot of shipping going to Vietnam and from the West Coast, especially, well, no, all the ports on the West Coast. I joined the Seamen's Union of the Pacific off of that tanker. And just worked out of the union hall for a long time. Most of the jobs, if you're looking to get a job quickly, were going to Vietnam.
Interesting. So how much are you away when you're in those entry-level jobs? I mean, do you have a home or an apartment somewhere, or are you just always on board and you're always traveling?
In the 60s, you were always traveling. You got a couple weeks vacation. Paid vacation a year. So if you worked on a schedule where you got paid all the time, you basically were on the ship all the time. But working out of the hall, there was no stigma attached to quitting, leaving after 2-3 months, whatever. So between the surfing and the ships, I spent probably 3/4 of the time, 2/3 of my time on ships, and the rest of the time in Mexico or chasing girls or whatever. Which was great. You know, I had money. It was very nice.
What a great life you've led.
Well, that part, yes, that part was great. And actually, McAndrew, I don't know about you, either of you, but a lot of my friends, 17, 18, 20 years old, there's this angst about what am I going to do with my life? I'm going to school. It looks like my parents want me to be a lawyer or an accountant, or so I don't want to have anything to do. A lot of that with my friends, I never had that doubt. After the first ship, I knew that's what I was going to do. I saw that there was no ceiling. It was all up to you how far you went in it, because you just go to the Coast Guard when you've got the requisite time and take their test and get the next endorsement. You work your way right up, working out of the Union Hall. We weren't attached necessarily to any one company, especially when you're starting and so I just saw all that clearly, thank God, and stayed with it. I loved it.
So that answered one of my questions. How do you work your way up in a ship? And are there specialties? You know, do you say, hey, I want to be, and this is, I'm showing my ignorance here, but I always want to be in the engine room, or no, I want to be the captain someday. Mm-hmm. I mean, how do you get that specialty?
Just by aptitude, you know, what appeals to you. My first job, I was a wiper. I didn't think I'd want to spend the rest of my life in the engine room. If you're mechanically inclined, it's a great thing, because there's nothing but machinery and resistors and levers and valves and noise down there. Anyway, then I worked in the stewards department, and then I worked back in the engine room, I think. But I saw the guys on deck. That's what I decided I wanted to do. The deck seamanship appealed to me. All of the all the tackle, the booms, the ropes, the steering, the lookout, all that stuff. I thought that was pretty. It was cool. So I started, when I finally realized I'm going to advance in this. I'm not just going to take any job that comes around. That's when I started concentrating, working on deck, and you work out. You have to spend 2 years. I'm going back a ways. 2 years sea time as an ordinary seaman. Then you could take a test from the Coast Guard that you could either go to a school and get ready for, or you can learn it yourself. It's all basic stuff, so I just learned it on my own. Amazing. You take a test and you become an AB. Then 2 years, 3 years as an AB, and you can take a test to be a third mate if you're working on deck, and you just work your way up. A year's sea time as a third mate, and you take a test for second mate. Just work your way up.
Wow. And is a year's time sea time, is that actual sea time? So not just the job.
That's a fine distinction. Well, sea time as in when you're in the ocean and the propeller's turning, no. You can be at the dock and be getting sea time, you know, loading and discharging. Mm-hmm. But when you get on time off, that does not count. So you get what's called discharges. When you go on a ship, you sign on, and then when you get off, you sign off, and you get what's called a discharge. You just save your discharges. It showed how long you worked on the ship, and you had enough discharges for AB, to sit for AB. Went to the Coast Guard and took the test.
So what was the approximate size of a crew on these ships? And then what were the shifts? Are there multiple shifts? Are they 12 hours? What are, does that work?
There's, when I started there, it was typically about 40 in the crew. Okay. And now they're down to 20, 22,
wow.
18. There's been a big push for automation. I think they went as far as they could go, and even too far. There were ships with just six people on them.
Oh, my gosh.
And that's it's just not enough, especially in the safety situation. If there's a fire or anything, a breakdown, it's just not enough. So I've seen them backed off on that, and they're right in that 18 to 22 number in the crews. And as far as working hours, there's two types of work. There's day work and there's watches. If you're on day work, which say the stewards department's on, you work during the day. You get the meals ready and close up the galley at the end of the day, all clean. Start again the next morning. But the rest of the work that has to go on around the clock is split into what they call watches. And it's the watches are 4 hours on and then 8 hours off. So if you're on the 8 to 12 watch, that means you're on watch from 8 in the morning to noon. You're off until 8 at night. Then you work again from 8 at night to midnight. There's the 8 to 12, the 12 to 4, and the 4 to 8 watch.
Interesting.
So that's how they split the work up. And typically there's you stand your watches, but you work also in the hours between, not all the hours between, but maintenance type work for overtime.
Okay. So before we get to piloting, bar piloting, where did you, were you always in the Pacific or have you been all around the world?
I haven't been all around the world, but I've been in a lot of places. The last ship I was on, we ran from South America and the Caribbean to East Coast of the U.S. That was a really good run. I was captain on that ship for 7 years. Learned a lot about rum and Cuban cigars.
So do you have a favorite ocean?
No.
Oh, I love that answer.
That was my stupidest question of the day.
It's not a stupid question.
No, I love that.
All the oceans have their characteristics. Yeah. You know, the Mediterranean is way different than the North Pacific. But no, I don't. I like it all.
So you didn't grow up at the mouth of the Columbia. How do you make that transition and interest into piloting, and why here at the mouth of the Columbia River?
If you sail, to become a pilot, it's a very political job and actually closely held in most places, family. So it really helps if your father or your uncle or whatever was in the business. Here on the Columbia River bar, not the river, but the bar itself, all of the pilots have to have had at least 2 years sea time as masters of ocean-going vessels. And when you get that kind of experience, wide-ranging experience, rather than growing up in the Chesapeake with your father or your uncle, a pilot, and you work on the pilot boat and work your way up, you get a good oversight of how pilotage is run all over the world. And that instills, I think, to a man and woman on the bar, a rather strong dislike to the nepotism system. It does not make the best pilot. If you're, and I think that's true about nepotism, period. It's a bad way to choose someone, especially in such a safety-sensitive business, to just take sons and whatever. So the bar pilots are exclusive in the United States. This is not unusual in the world, but they're exclusive in the United States with the requirement that you have to sail 2 years as a master. And to lead up to how you do that, how you become a pilot, ship's masters, if they're at a certain point in their career, I think all of them come to a point where they look at their future. Am I going to spend the next 15 years on ships doing this, which is a great job if you're working for a good company, or am I going to do something different? The only things different that a ship captain can do if he goes ashore is to work in the home office in New York or Singapore or whatever, or be a pilot. And so shipmasters that are interested in pilotage would look all over the country at pilotage jobs. And I didn't look all over the country. I thought, well, I think I would like to be a pilot. And the only place where I could live in a rural setting with some dignity, have, you know, a little bit of property and not and be a pilot was here. In Seattle, you know, they're on freeways all the time going, they take a ship to Tacoma and their next job is in Anacortes. That's all on the freeway. That's same thing with San Francisco, LA on the West Coast. I didn't want to be a pilot in the East Coast or the Gulf. As much because of nepotism as the fact that I couldn't live with dignity as I saw it. So this place really appealed to me from the go when I really first started thinking about going ashore. So you just make yourself, in those days, you made yourself known to the pilots that you would like to be considered, and you basically campaigned. You go to the pilot office and meet all the pilots, introduce yourself, talk to them, they get to know you, you get to know them, and then you're considered. The next time they took a pilot, you would be in the list. And nowadays, you go to the state, and the State Board of Maritime Pilots selects the pilots. But I have to say that the board is good about listening to the pilot groups themselves as who they think is the best candidate and sending that person to be a pilot.
So How many years were you a Columbia River bar pilot?
22.
22 years. How many pilots were there when you first started?
22.
And how many are there now?
There's 14, I think.
Okay.
Because of the helicopter.
Oh,
excellent. Okay. So I've read your book, and I'm so excited and pleased that you let the Historical Society publish it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been flying off the shelves. It's available the Heritage Museum, the Carriage House, the Maritime Museum, Lucy's Books, and I think that's probably it. But why did you write this book, and what did you want people to know? Because it's an easy read for a non-boat person, ship person like me. It made it very understandable.
I thought the history was very interesting from the time I started as a pilot. I've always liked history in the first place. And when I first started here as a pilot, I had a gist of the history, and I paid attention and read things as they came along, and all of a sudden it dawned on me, maybe it's never been written, the history, and it's worth recording. And I had enough of it in my head at the time to make a start on the whole thing. I thought this is a good thing to do for a lot of reasons. And so 12 years later, you guys published it.
I love it. And the book is A History of Pilotage on the Columbia River Bar by Theron Riggs, who is also giving a talk later this week on Thursday.
Thursday night at Fort George. Doors open at 6. Program starts at 7.
This is just kind of a tease tonight. This is just like a little bit compared to the talk, because the talk is longer, and then there's also back and forth too, right? I mean,
yeah, I like the back and forth. Yeah. That's good. Anyway, I wrote the book for pilots. Originally, the idea was just for pilots to get a history where we're all coming from and how to deal with things that come up in the future, because history always repeats itself. But in the writing process, a few people encouraged me to make it more for a general audience, and I expanded it a little bit and massaged it like that. But I wrote it for the pilots, really.
So I liked especially that I learned a lot about Captain Flavelle, and the book is not about Captain Flavelle, but of course he plays a role. And then one of my favorite discussions, and when I was looking through your first draft, early drafts, I asked you about this. You talk about the introduction of the helicopter, and that there was some debate amongst the pilots.
It was very controversial.
And why was that, and where did you come down on it?
I thought it was a terrible idea. And I was one of those guys, I'm a squarehead, Norwegian, right? Scottish. No, we don't do that. You know, I came here to ride boats, and I thought they were dangerous. I didn't buy in that they would really save the system money, and that they'd be safer. And all that, and we were divided about in half. It was really tough on the group, but I finally came. I let them prove it out, and then started riding helicopters when they were established.
Well, it's a tremendous book, and I'm so glad again that you let us publish it. And I think everybody should read it, because we all love watching the pilot boats out there. We are a river town and a commerce town with all this maritime trade, and you really explain it really well. And everybody should come and hear you talk Thursday. And thank you so much for being here.
Yeah.
Go make some history. We'll catch you next week. Thanks for listening.
Thank you for joining us for An Adventure in History. An Adventure in History is created and produced by the Clatsop County Historical Society and brought to you by KMUN.